Explain a bit about some goings on that are motivated by current observation, combination of current observation and some very old questions about one of the oldest members of the high energy astrophysics compact object zoo, namely rotation powered pulsars, sometimes known as radio pulsars. But as obvious from the title, we have known since the 70s that at least some of them emit high energy gamma rays. And for background, what's meant by gamma rays here is things that are kind of hundreds of MeV to hundreds of GeV energies. So these pictures that are up there kind of illustrate large fractions of what I have to do. The beautiful movies and the plot of that comes from one of the movies are all due to my collaborator Anatoly Spitkovsky, who's at Princeton, whom I've known for a substantial period. The panel with the spiky stuff on it is gamma ray observations of a particular pulsar, which I deliberately chose one that is not famous. This is, its telephone number is J1048-5832. And when I was a graduate student at Harvard, there was a retired professor who was very famous, Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, who was one of the people who determined the distance scale based on Cepheid variables. And she knew every nova by name, was a friend of hers. There are pulsar people who know a large number of the 2,000 and some known pulsars that are by their telephone numbers. But me, I'm just a dumb theorist. This one I picked out because it's at random rather than picking the Crab and Vela pulsars, which were the first ones identified as gamma ray pulsars. So the characteristic feature you see in the light, so this is the light curve of this particular pulsar as a function of energy, broken up here in 100 MeV to 300 MeV, 300 to 1,000 MeV, and then everything above a GeV, and this is everything. And this all comes from the Fermi satellite. 2 years ago, NASA launched a satellite with a detector on it, which had been in development for 15 years, applying for the first time modern particle physics detection techniques to the detection of astrophysical gamma rays from space. That itself is if you like science politics, a fascinating science politics of how to persuade the guru of gamma ray astronomy in NASA to do something new. The project was the brainchild of Robert Hofstadter, who was a famous experimental particle physicist, now dead. But and it's extraordinarily successful. There, it sees all sorts of things in this GeV-ish kind of range. Pulsars are a big fraction of what they see. There's now 65 of these gamma ray pulsars known. In the light curve, what you're seeing is a function of time. The pulse, starting here, it goes through a pulse, and you wait, the full cycle starts over again. So this is just two pulses lined up one after another. And they keep coming. This one I don't remember its pulse period, but the typical one of these gamma ray pulsars is 100 to 300 milliseconds. They're not the fastest rotators known. However, within the whole zoo, there are quite a number of true millisecond pulsars, things with pulse periods down in the 10 milliseconds. And in one case, less. So it's been quite a treasure trove of new things. And trying to understand what gives rise to these gamma rays and use that to exploit what's happening is very important. The pictures are, the two movies are of the force-free MHD solutions for the structure of the magnetosphere around a pulsar. These systems, so far as we know, are able to characterize the energies in the system, are characterized by a magnetic field surrounding the neutron star, compact object, where the energy density of the magnetic field is large compared to the rest energy density of any material that we are able to measure or suspect. That puts you into a regime where if you tried to do, you wanted to do the fluid dynamics of the magnetic field, but keeping track of the inertia and pressures and other such things, the equations that describe them, your model become incredibly stiff, and it's really hard to solve. So why not throw away the things that are made stiff, which aren't carrying any of the energy anyway, and do it as entirely an electromagnetic object? So this is an application. These things are done by solving the equations of electromagnetism with a special assumption that there is enough material around, conducting material, such that if I have a magnetic field that's poking that way and I rotate it, in general I'll get a vacuum electric field which includes a component of E parallel to B. The idea of force-free MHD is that there's enough plasma around such that the electrons and possibly positively charged particles adjust so as to get rid of that E parallel, and you're left with something that has only a perpendicular component of E. That's what standard magnetohydrodynamics does. But here it goes further, that there is no equation of motion for the plasma. All there are is a couple of peculiar constitutive relationships telling you how the currents are related to the electromagnetic fields. And Lewis has worked a lot, and his group have worked a lot on this in the context of black hole physics. But where it all starts is in studying these objects, and many of the concepts that are used in discussing black hole magnetospheres with a disk supporting the magnetic field, I think, come straight out of this world. For many years, this concept of the so-called force-free magnetosphere was around, but nobody could solve the equation. In the last decade, that the equations have been solved, always computationally, for reasons that are aside from my talk, so I won't go into, but the resulting problem, even for something as simple as the aligned rotator with a magnetic moment parallel to rotation axis, so the fields are all steady in any frame you care to think about, provides a rather unusual kind of nonlinear eigenvalue, boundary value problem that it got parked in the hands of analytically minded applied mathematicians for many years who kept trying to guess the answer with no success. So finally, a clever guy named Yannis Kontopoulos said he's going to try it computationally and invented an interesting relaxation scheme. The aligned rotator has been solved repeatedly now with greater accuracy. These things are evolutionary problems. You can write down the equations describing this so that the fields evolve in time. And what's done is to start the rotating object with a magnetic field and some plasma and spin it up and watch what happens. And what you're hoping will happen, because the expectation is the pattern of the field is steady in the curved rotating frame, which is what that movie wants you to think. So you look at it, and right here, there's a neutron star. The two colors represent field lines emanating from the opposite poles. So one color represents field lines where the magnetic field goes into the star at the surface. The other color, field lines coming out of the star from at the surface. And you can look at it, and you see, well, if you look sharp, you'll see there's some field lines which are kind of closed near the neutron star, as if it remembers that it's a dipole. Others have been stretched out and form what's known as a relativistic wind, and they stretch out and become more or less straight as you go outwards, but also curve back because for the force-free model, the electromagnetic inertia, that is b squared over 4 pi c squared, is effectively a mass density, provides a load on the system, and so it drags the field lines backwards as you spin it. For those of you who remember textbook electromagnetism, there is an exact solution for rotating a bar magnet in vacuum. And if probably you've never drawn the field lines for that, but if you do, they look kind of like this. With one big difference, you get things where field lines come out of one pole and out of the other pole, and they're oppositely directed. But in the vacuum rotator, they're always closed. If you go far enough, you'll wind outward, and then the field line turns around and goes all the way back again. Here, with the plasma around and the changing the direction of the field line causes there to be a current that flows in a sheet separating these regions. That, in essence, cuts the field lines and lets them extend off to infinity. So they don't close. The open field lines don't close anywhere that you want to do. And some people realize, well, they must close because that's what del dot B equals zero means. Not true. All of E equals zero means is that field lines never end. And so in astrophysics, most of the time, field lines go wandering off, take off and go off into the universe and go, we don't know where. The toy problems of vacuum magnetic fields with closed field lines of dipoles, quadrupoles, et cetera, is actually a specialized situation. But it applies to here, close in. Here you can see, for a 60-degree rotator, you can see this dense color is where the current flow is flowing that's separating the closed field lines here from the open field lines there. And there is a current sheet that exists here which wraps around the closed field lines, ends what is in formal magnetohydrodynamics is a cusp point to the magnetic field. It looks like this. The lines come down like that and then continue on into a current sheet which is thin that separates the opposite polarity open field lines. That's here. That's a very interesting structure in its own right, which I won't talk about today, but it's, if I were to hang around here a long time. And
outward, it has a radial component.
Yes.
But it doesn't end up depleting the charge.
So this is, in fact, much of the problems of solving the pulsar magnetosphere as a theoretical object have been revolving around the question of what is the return current? If you spin an object, these are unusual objects. We look at something like the sun, and it forms an atmosphere around it because the temperature is high and the scale height is high. These objects are cool. The scale height of the atmosphere of a neutron star is about 1 centimeter, contrast to the scale height of the atmosphere of the Earth, which is 10 kilometers. So gravity confines ordinary electrically neutral plasma to a thin layer at the surface. The concept that was introduced shortly after pulsars were discovered is if you rotate an object like this in vacuum, it develops vacuum electric fields, which include a component parallel to B, and that rips off one side of the charge. And the first suggestion, and it still underlies a lot of what's going on now, is that one side of the charge comes whizzing out of the pole here if the magnetic moment vector is pointing like that, what's coming out of the pole over here is electron. Okay? Over that whole polar and there are field lines that connect off to infinity. For normal parameters, over that whole polar cap, it emits only electron. The concept is this current flows off to infinity and then supports this wound up field structure. But how do you stop from being charged up? So this is a huge history. The clue to this is that the sign of the current sheet is such that it's carrying the return current. And so now I'm going to use a word I don't like, but I believe in the open-circuited model. The way this system works is the way Tom Edison made his DC power plant system work. He had a DC power plant. He had transmission lines. He carried current off to everybody's house. They ran it through their lights. But he didn't have another wire which returned the current from every house back to the power plant. He just stuck the other side of your light bulb to Earth. Let the Earth take care of it. The Earth's got eddy currents running on all the time. You know, you take some charge to the power plant, send it to your light bulb, run it through, get some light, plug it into Earth. It'll wander off. The power plant picks up by spinning the armature of the generator, paralyzer voltages, picks up charges which it gets from the floor or the outside. And the Earth takes care of. Now, there's a huge reservoir of free charge sitting around in the Earth, even though it's largely neutral system. That's my opinion. And I can't tell you the number of interesting arguments you can get into people who subscribe to a different religion. This model seems to work for the kinds of questions we've asked of it, and it seems to make sense as an electrodynamic object. And my topic here has to do with how you put physics into what you mean by these return currents. This picture on the right is something that Spakovsky and one of his students did of asking the question, can you make this force-free rotator and its current sheet be the source of those pulses? And they did so in a kinematic way. They said, take the region of this current sheet, which is that orangey layer right there, and paint it with emissivity, which is beamed parallel to B, because we think the gamma rays, to get a gamma ray, you need a very high-energy particle. It has to be at least a GeV for a GeV photon. If you take the hypothesis that what you got out of this, it was propagating parallel to the magnetic field. Somewhere along the way, you violated this E parallel B equals zero assumption to some level, and accelerated charges whizzing along parallel to B. They will then radiate. They're moving on a curved path. Moving on a curved path, you get synchrotron radiation, but now it's synchrotron radiation with the curvature of the magnetic field. That's the most popular model. There are more complex ways you get real synchrotron radiation. But it's always beamed in the direction the particles are going, and the particles are going parallel to B. You get the lighthouse. This is what makes a pulsar, is a lighthouse. You're rotating a beam of light around. It comes from particles that are beamed because they're moving relativistically parallel to B. They were trying to ask the question whether the geometry of this current sheet provides pulses. When you look at it from the outside, look like this. And what they did was to take that current sheet and paint it with emissivity by hand. They didn't put a physical model for how they generate radiation. They wanted to ask, are the beaming properties good? There are a variety of models that work kind of like this for using physics that's different than what I'm talking about here, which produce that answer and are able to replicate beaming. And to be convincing to your colleagues in the work in this field, the first thing you have to show is that you can beam the radiation right. So that's what they set out to do, and succeeded quite well with some interesting wrinkles on the problem. So that's background. One of the things I learned from my postdoc mentor was, if you're going to do astrophysics, don't get wrapped up studying some interesting physical process in excruciating detail. It's something I know physicists who get into astrophysics who are sort of the have process will travel type point of view. I know something about nuclear physics, so I'm going to take my nuclear physics and use it to explain something interesting. And the ones who are intelligent about that do really well. I mean, there's some classic examples who started in nuclear physics and then became really accomplished astrophysicists. But astrophysics is about modeling what you see, ultimately, and you need to pay attention to a range of things. So Jerry Ostreicher's view of the world was, you follow the energy. Where's the energy in the system? That'll tell you what physics you should be doing. So the energy in these systems is given by their spin down. You look at a pulsar, you get repetitive pulses, which after a suitable averaging procedure provide a very stable clock. And here is the answer to what you get over the population as it was about a year ago. You get the period, which provides a very stable clock. We now know them about from 10 seconds down to a millisecond, a few milliseconds. The absence of 1 millisecond pulsars is an interesting fact in its own right. There's a couple different populations here, clearly. You look at this, it says a big grouping of stuff over here, a big grouping of stuff over here, and kind of a paucity there. It's saying, keeps astrophysicists really busy. There's a different evolutionary history to this. Between millisecond pulsars and normal pulsars. That's not my problem today, but you find, as I think probably would be surprised if any of you hasn't heard this, but you find out the period is not strictly stable, and all these objects are slowly lengthening. So there's a period derivative, which is positive. Through a chain of astrophysical reasoning, which I won't repeat, but the conclusion is what you're looking at is you're maintaining a stable pulse because you have a rotating flywheel. It's very massive. That gives you a nice stable clock. The fact that you're down to milliseconds tells you it has to be a neutron star. It's the only astrophysical object whose equilibrium configuration is known that's able to do that. You could, in principle, get something like this out of some sort of rotating fluctuation in the inner edge of a disk around a suitable stellar mass black hole, which also has millisecond periods, but making it really stable like this is beyond anybody's imagination. You got to have something that looks like a rock. And you find the period is lengthening, and that's interpreted then as an increase of the rotation period. That's expressed this way. What can be fit to the data is this: the angular frequency, 2 pi over the period. The frequency you're going down is minus some constant times the frequency to some power. And I'll come back to the modern form of electromagnetic spin down that's applied by the force-free models shortly. But all of the theories which you can actually solve say this number n, the breaking index is 3, with no wiggle room as far as the basic theory of spin down is concerned. The preface was something I'll say a little bit later. When it's measured in about half a dozen pulsars, you're able to do and count enough pulses in a stable enough way, you can measure what n is as well as what the proportionality constant is. And n is always less than 3.
Magnetic field is constant? Or
so if I took this formula as it is and said k is a constant, it says what's in here is really the magnetic moment squared over c squared over c cubed. So one assumption that's built into this, and what's usually done is say that the magnetic moment is constant. It's frozen into the conducting. This neutron star is a good conductor. The currents that are inside it that support this magnetic field that has an exterior dipole moment don't change in any reasonable time. And any attempt to work out what the conductivity and resistivity of the neutron star matter is concerned gives rise to, at the very least, the decay time of the magnetic moment is millions of years. Okay? And there's been a long disputatious argument about whether we're seeing in this PP dot diagram evidence for magnetic field decay or not. But it's over a long time. The current thinking is that for these pulsars here, it's the situation consistent with there is no magnetic field decay. The dipole moment is fixed throughout the lifetime they spend as visible objects, millions of years. There is an interesting story that says the magnetic fields here, which are much weaker, these have Tergagauss magnetic fields, as inferred by measuring that constant from an observed omega and omega dot. This constant is actually the ratio of magnetic moment squared to the moment of inertia of the neutron star. So there's an interesting story that says these guys got to what they started as these guys, but we're in a binary star system that was having mass transferred down onto the neutron star, which when you, while you're doing the mass transfer, it'll spin the neutron star up. So in Mal Rudelman's inimitable language, these are the resurrected pulsars. They evolved here until they got off into this region where we stopped seeing them. And then they're living in a binary. The mass transfer phase started, and they moved like this and landed up over there. To land up here, they have to have magnetic fields much weaker. If the magnetic field is 10 to 12 Gauss, the accreting stuff is held off at distances such that its orbital frequency is no shorter than about a second. Orbital period is no shorter than about a second. So you have to a millisecond. You have to have fields not at a teragauss, but less than a gigagauss. And there's an interesting possibility that there is magnetic field evolution such that while during accretion, you make that magnetic moment change. How that's done is an interesting astrophysical problem, which I'd like not to go any further into it than that.
So the 10 to the 14 seconds is how long it takes to shed period, which is 10 million years. So that doesn't tell you which one changes faster. Is it the magnetic field or the period?
Oh, you have all these objects in here which form a nice sequence. Then here you have things where the period is changing much faster than the putative lower limit to the decay time. So yes, you know, if I pick off the pulsars that are living sort of around here with sort of 1 to 10 second periods, there's this correspondence, but it's nothing special about it. I can pick lots of pulsars where that correspondence there's no correspondence at all. So in the interest of not saying they're really all part of the same population, nobody really gets into usually gets into having the magnetic field change as a way to explain the basics of this thing here. This thing right here, people sometimes say, when you measure that, the so-called breaking is, it's always less than 3. One way to have that happen is for the pulsars which are on the young, fast-rotating variety. There's a reason, find reasons why the magnetic field actually might be increased. If you make this k here increase with time, the end result of the combination here is to act as if this breaking index is less than 3. That's one of the several different possibilities that are around for that. And there are no good observations that allow to discriminate between the different models. Anyway, that's off in a different direction. The force-free magnetosphere looks like this. These are solutions of the aligned rotator. This plot comes from the best of them, done by Andrei Timokhin. which what you see here is closed field lines. This is dipole where it gets more and more stretched. You get to the last closed field line here, which ends in this sort of cusp-like point there. In ideal MHD, that's an infinitely sharp point. The rest of these things are open field lines here, out of which we think there's outflow. So the next thing you need to do in order to say that is this tells you something about how I had a rotating dipole which was acted on the neutron star with an electromagnetic brake to slow it down. The earliest hypothesis was just look up the answer in a textbook. I act as if it were in a vacuum. Look up the radiation of magnetic dipole radiation, which says if I have a bar magnet going around, which is an oblique rotator, it'll radiate off electromagnetic waves and it'll carry away angular momentum of the system. And these numbers of 10 to the 12 Gauss came first out of that. However, if you're a person working on stars, you ask two things. Does it have mass loss? And what is the mass loss that goes along with the energy loss? This we understand much less well. We know most about the mass loss by studying these nebulae that surround the younger pulsars, visible regions which are illuminated and shining in synchrotron radiation. So the most famous and often the prettiest is the Crab Nebula here, both in the X-ray picture, and this picture tries to take everything we know into account as radio emission and infrared emission from the nebula. So this is the inner region which is showing up in this interesting X-ray torus. The neutron star is sitting right in there, that dot. The various ways we have measuring where its rotation axis is pointing, says the long, long, long axis of this thing. As you can see, as I go from radio through infrared to X-ray, it gets smaller and smaller. So that is a manifestation of the pulsars injecting the particles. There's a surrounding magnetic field, which the models all tell us the magnetic field comes from neutron stars, wound up in a torus. And you can do an optical polarization and now an X-ray polarization, the polarization of this stuff in here, and it is the polarization directions are such as if the magnetic field is wound up in a torus. So it's a good story. And the fact the nebula gets smaller and smaller, go to higher energy, is burn off. To get the synchrotron radiation in X-rays requires 10 to 30 TeV particles. We see gamma ray emission from these systems also. There, the gamma ray telescopes don't have the angular resolution to give you a good picture, but that takes PeV particles, and with the inferred magnetic fields, which you can get estimates of in several different ways, the magnetic field in this region is probably somewhere around a hundred to a couple hundred microgauss. The lifetime of a GeV emitting particle in that is about a month. So the inference is that the gamma ray source is very compact. You can see here as I go to higher and higher photon energy, it gets more and more compact. The direct evidence is coming from the pulsar. So now if you know the age of the system, or you know the lifetime of the particles that are radiating for the X-rays, it's the latter which controls how far they get, you can infer what the rate of injection of particles. And the interesting inference is, in studying the mass loss, the rate of injection of particles is very large compared to what is known in this trait as the Goldreich-Julian current rate, which is a number of particles is C. I have a rotating magnetic field, so it has a potential electrical potential drop across the region of the magnetosphere that's inside that the potential drop across the magnetosphere between there and there is what goes into that thing called phi. That number for the Crab pulsar is around 40 petavolts. Your typical pulsar of 1 second period, it's more like a few teravolts. That's the mental space you live in this business. When I give talks to people who do high current electron beams about this stuff, they're always impressed. You know, the numbers are all in this tera and peta. The current flow is also tera amps to peta amps. The current flow that's coming out with this thing here, the thing that I said was all open circuited, for the crab pulsar is around a petaamp. And that's this, C times the potential divided by an elementary charge. This is the minimum flow rate you can get in order to make these magnetospheres work. What we observe is flow rates much larger than that. To explain the X-rays, you need injection of particles, which is at least 10 to the 4 times this. So there's some source of plasma beyond simply extracting current. And that's thought to be electron-positron pair creation. That is, if you accelerate the charged particles that you extracted to energies of sort of TeV, moving along a curved path, a magnetic field line, down in the 10 to 12 Gauss magnetic field region, they will radiate gamma rays, kind of GeV-ish gamma rays. That's the first model that was proposed for gamma ray pulsars. And the GeV gamma rays moving through this super strong magnetic field will convert to an E plus minus pair. They're interacting with the virtual photons that are another way of representing the magnetic field. It's the direct analog of firing a gamma ray at an atomic nucleus, and it converts in the electrostatic field around the nucleus. So I used to be very happy with this because I would do calculations of the pair production rate according to these kind of stories and get this kind of number, and that explains the X-ray source, and I just shut my eyes to the fact there's more radiation there. But if, as is likely, all the radio-emitting electrons that are sitting in this nebula, stuff that gives rise to this, came from the pulsar, you need this number here, not 10 to the 4th, but greater than 10 to the 6th. This is a current puzzle. We don't really understand how the machine is producing that much plasma. I'd give another whole talk about that. But that's the basic story we have. The plasma that makes it force free is thought to be pair creation within the magnetosphere, which then puts enough plasma out there that you can short out E parallel most everywhere. Yet we see these gamma rays, and so we got to do some acceleration somehow. So at this stage, I now go off into stuff that people is now kind of the current frontiers. Why is this magnetosphere like the Earth? Is one way of asking the question. The Earth has a magnetosphere which interacts with the solar wind. The solar wind plasma magnetized by interacting with the magnetospheric plasma causes the field lines of the solar wind to be connected to those of the dipole and yank them backwards, forming a drawn-out tail-like structure that's in the anti-summer direction. That tail-like structure has in it a current sheet, which is subject to what you see in this picture down there of reconnection at the current sheet. The oppositely directed field lines like to go from this to this. To do that requires, if your particles are frozen to the field lines, requires doing something that breaks the freezing of magnetic flux to the charged particles, and they have to do something that is dissipated. So this thing, these pictures down there, are a simulation of what happens to a very young pulsar, which is spitting out a very high-density flow, forming this aligned rotator structure, because we assumed it to be an aligned rotator, and letting the dissipation that's built into the code that did this take care of providing dissipation that supports these reconnection anomalies. You can see, and what it does is just the same stuff that we actually observe with satellites out in the Earth's magnetosphere. This current sheet, which used to be the colloidal field lines went like this and like that, they like to break up into these islands. And they're around here, the field lines make loops like that, and they create X points and O points in the thing, and the whole thing forms these blobs of plasma that are spitting out at the local so-called Alphane speed, which for these pulsars is essentially the speed of light. So one of the things that is where modeling these things is going is saying there is this so-called reconnection occurring, which causes this kind of temporal variability even in the frame of the system. Now, in this calculation, the dissipation is just numerical. It depends upon the fact that it's a finite difference code, which appears as a dissipation, which in certain respects is if you had a resistivity. One of the challenges is to get that under control and have a physical model of what's happening. Here's the result for the force-free model, which the force-free model does not show these phenomena. Right? Something has to be added to the force-free model so as to get it to start doing these dissipative things. When you see that dissipation going on, there are large impulsive inductive electric fields, which are interesting candidates for doing the acceleration. You can take, though, the force-free model without any of that and find out what its spin-down is. And here's the modern theory of spin-down determined computationally. This number up front, magnetic moment squared, omega fourth, that's the same as you see in the vacuum theory. And you can understand that as a simple question of energy conservation, where your energy is mainly carried as pointing flux. Dependence on the obliquity here, the angle between the magnetic moment and omega, is new. The vacuum rotator is you throw this away and say that number k in front is 2/3. And look that number, that answer up in the textbook. The aligned rotator calculations, which are time stationary computational, don't have this. They have this, and the k out front is determined to be 1.36. Okay, so that's the result of a triumph of computational physics, is to change 1 to 1.36.
Your last slide. So you didn't say what Ry and RL were.
Okay, let me back up then. That's the danger of this. Because,
okay, but maybe it wasn't the last slide.
I went the wrong way. Sorry. Come on, you're here somewhere. There we go.
Yes, so did you say about Ry and RL?
So Ry is this point which in this picture is the radius of this point right here. Or maybe I'll use the cartoon there. There's Ry. RL is a so-called light cylinder. So if you said a charged particle stuck into this thing will co-rotate with the magnetic field, at this radius it will be moving at this, it'll be rotational velocity will be the speed of light. And that is regarded as, and turns out to be, a good number for what is the limit of the co-rotating part of the magnetosphere. This particular set of calculations Timokin did as he was exploring the idea that for reasons that were kind of done by hand, co-rotation ended at some place inside the light cylinder. To get that to happen requires quite substantial voltage drops parallel to B. And the evolutionary model is doing force-free. It always starts off sometimes inside here, but evolves until Ry becomes equal to RL. So the traditional idea that the co-rotating part of the magnetosphere extends to the light cylinder is still regarded, seems to be true as far as this theory is concerned. None of these force-free solutions are known analytically. Yeah, this says here, suppose I say that the torque is according to that expression I had in the first place, but I do it now with a magnetosphere that extends not to R light cylinder, but extends to some Ry that's smaller. So then you figure out what the torque is for that. It looks the same, except it depends on the ratio of Ry to RL. This is a measure of how much open magnetic flux there is versus closed. And one thing that we did while working on these calculations right here was, does this kind of variability possibly have something to do with the fact that the breaking index is less than 3? And if you say, well, RL and Ry aren't the same, and you let the ratio evolve, there's a different kind of evolution. Remember I said you could get that thing we didn't quite understand, the breaking index is not 3 but less than 3. One way is to get the magnetic field to get greater. A different way of saying it is that the rate of change of open magnetic flux to closed, which will happen as the closed magnetosphere expands, is done at a rate that's different than the traditional answer that the closed magnetosphere goes only to RL. RL is proportional to the period of the star. So as the period of the star gets longer, the closed zone gets bigger. That means open magnetic flux has to become closed. That means reconnection. If you say this is a physical process and not just drawing of lines, And you can imagine that RY is different than RL. If the ratio of RY to RL changes in time, you can also affect the breaking. So this was exploring that idea. There is not a good mechanism to explain this at the present time. It's one of the possibilities of dealing with why the pulsars aren't behaving according to the simplest idealized model. I mean, everybody says, well, you know, that's the simplest idealized model. Surely it's not that simple, but the question is, when you get observations that disagree with the simplest idealized model, why? You'd learn something about it if you could understand why. So I got to move on. These are a bunch of comments about what the force field model tells you. A bunch of things are interesting for the properties of the emission physics, which I won't go into any detail, except that it provides us something which was in the picture I showed you in the first place of the current sheet painted so it radiated. It provides you an interesting site where there might be dissipation. Just as in where numerical dissipation occurred, these current sheets are places where the field loves to be dissipated. Solar flares occur because current sheets in the solar corona are being dissipated, on and on like that. So the force field model has provided us with a platform to try to do better than we've done before. This one slide I'm going to skip. It doesn't really add very much. So now is the prospect of what to do. The force field, ignore the upper line there, it addresses a different point that I don't want to spend time on. But here's our basic current flow structure there. It maps back to the surface kind of like this. There's the polar current coming out. There's a return current, which is the opposite sign of charges, leaving going like that. Okay? And if you want to have this stuff contribute to the torque, these currents have to get off, charges have to get off to infinity. They can't close in the outer magnetic sphere and come back again, because then there's no pointing flux being supported by the current flow far away from the star. So this type of thing is known as auroral current flow, and I'll show you a picture of the aurora in a moment, because it has its origin the same way. The experimental observation that is most interesting to me at the moment is trying to get a grip on this diagram. The gamma ray observers have gone and measured the gamma ray fluxes. The flux that you get is the luminosity in gamma rays divided by distance squared and divided by some solid angle into which the radiation is beamed. Usually there's a 4 pi there because we're looking at an isotropic radiator. These are manifestly not isotropic radiators. So this diagram is constructed with the best we know of the distances of these objects and an assumption that the beaming angle is like a steradian. And that comes about because the pulses we see are typically rather widely separated. So if you imagine what we're doing is cutting through a cone of emission, all right, the rest of the cone is going around like that and sweeping across the sky, and it's roughly a steradian. So there's uncertainty, dispersion that right here represents a dispersion due to our uncertainty of what to do for the beaming correction, and is only going to get corrected if you have a good model. And the distance, which astronomical distances are famous for being hard to do, and astronomical distances to pulsars are hard, neutron stars are hard to do. So the observers are particularly interested at the moment of trying to improve their distances to try to narrow this up. There are two lines here, one that gamma ray luminosity judged this way is equal to the spin down energy. That means your whole energy budget went into gamma ray. And somebody yesterday asked me, what about these out points that have gamma ray luminosity greater than the spin down luminosity? Was I worried about that? The answer is no, because the uncertainties in the distances will easily take care of that. This one here is an interesting line. It says the luminosity is proportional to the square root of E dot. I didn't go through the formula for you, but the square root of E dot is essentially the voltage across the system. Take E dot, divide by C, take its square root, you'll get the number of stat volts that are present in the system. And since the energy content, you think of this as all in circuits, is a good way to do it. The energy losses are the current times the voltage, something we all learned long ago. If you use the full voltage of the magnetosphere times the current, you get the formula that I showed you before, magnetic moment squared omega fourth over C cubed. Here you get this line if you say the accelerating voltage that went into this stuff was limited, reached a maximum value, a value that was more or less the same over all these objects. There are reasons why that might be. which I'll probably avoid going into detail. It takes too much time. But you can see that these points do have seem to have some relationship to the square root of E dot line. And how good that relationship is, you've got all the observers jumping up and down saying we can get better distances, which I personally greatly support that they do that. So getting a model that does something like this is kind of the first place you start. You know, follow my original rule, follow the energy. And the great thing of these gamma rays is there's some sort of incoherent emission. The radio pulses are a collective emission like a TV antenna. Electron engineers on a TV antenna take groups of electrons and move them up and down with a given oscillatory frequency, but it's not single particle emission. It's a whole group irradiating at once. We don't understand that. We don't know how to interpret that in terms of the properties of the medium. Gamma rays is synchrotron emission or curvature emission, meaning synchrotron moving on a macroscopic arc like the magnetic field, or maybe even Compton upscatter of other photons. And we understand how to deal with that a lot better. So if you understand the gamma rays, you'll do better for the machine. Here's a few of the gamma ray pulsars. Crabb and Vela were first measured like this in the 70s. These others, 04 to 37 is a millisecond pulsar, also has the widely spread double pulse. 1048 is 124 milliseconds. It's a perfectly common garden for the zoo. And it's out of that separation of those two pulses you get this idea that the beaming is like a steradian. Now, there was a long-standing argument that whether the gamma rays came from near the surface or in the outer magnetosphere. Remember I mentioned we did all this pair creation, which is thought to occur near the surface. The harder gamma rays get absorbed and turned into pairs. Softer gamma rays should escape. Do we see them? Well, the answer is more or less no. It's a very interesting statement because we ought to. And so is that whole idea just wrong, or are we just this model too simple? And it's probably the latter, but no one's sure. But the question of whether it's low altitude or high altitude emission for the general common garden was settled this way. If you're coming from the surface, the harder gamma rays are cut off because of conversion to pairs. That creates a cutoff in the spectrum which is faster than exponential. It's e to the minus some optical depth. The opacity that goes into the optical depth is itself exponentially dependent on the photon energy. That gives you a sort of a like a guillotine. It just cuts off your spectrum really abruptly. The observations don't look like that. What they did was to fit observed gamma ray spectra with this thing, a parallel low energy with an exponential cutoff, but allowing for the possibility that the dependence of the cutoff was faster than energy to the one, and the power greater than one is rejected at some form of 16 sigma. So this cutoff is thought to be what you're looking at is the upper limit of the emission process, the maximum energy particles above which there will be no further, there are no particles to emit at higher energy, and any emission processes all tend to have an exponential roll-off that's intrinsic to the radiation of a single particle. This could be curvature emission, synchrotron emission, conceivably even inverse Compton. So how do you produce the particles that we're making this? It has to be at high altitude. It can't be down near the surface. That means more than about, to be really critical about it, more than about 10 neutron star radii. So there are classes of models that say that the radiation is coming either from a structure here that is pair plasma forms and cuts off the acceleration off the surface. But if you assume that the surrounding magnetosphere is a good conductor, there's never much paraelectric field over the edge. It leaves a gap with some leftover vacuum-like field which can continue to accelerate. That leads the so-called slot gap, which can extend outward, and radiate. Another model, which was done around the same time, is to say out here beyond in the original charge-separated magnetosphere, there's a critical surface beyond which plasma from the pole can't get to. And Mao Ruderman proposed that this region over here is vacuum-like and starts accelerating and radiating. So these are known as outer gaps, those are known as slot gaps, and those are the things that people do. What people do is say there's some unshorted vacuum. Personally, I don't like that, because what we know is the magnetosphere is producing this huge flux of particles, and you put in these gaps by hand, and the basic force-free model doesn't have such a thing. So can we do without it? that was that theoretical question was partly what was behind.
Yeah, of course.
They don't know.
Gamma rays, the telescope, the Fermi telescope has a collecting area. It's a big box that's about the stacks of silicon strip detectors. In a big box, that's probably its area projected down is about this pair of tables right here. That's huge for this business. But they don't begin to have sensitivity to tell what's going on a single pulse basis. So what you see is taken by weighting and accumulating photons with respect to a temporal template and stack all your arrival times of photons against the periodic thing. It used to be they could only do this, the photons are so rare they could only do it if they knew what the period was in advance, as the radio astronomers would tell you. Now, thanks to a clever maneuver by Bill Atwood and his friends, who's one of the experimentalists in the team, they've found the data analysis technique that lets them find gamma ray pulsars without prior knowledge of the period. But you're finding the pulses all representing averages. And it's turned out to be computationally possible to stack the photons and look at trial periods. So you don't know about pulse-to-pulse variability. It's probably there, but I couldn't say anything about it. So playing models with making a physical model of the magnetosphere, having it be dense, let it accelerate. My game has been to pursue things that we actually know from our heliospheric colleagues, who've been studying this kind of thing for a long time. What happens to a magnetosphere with currents flowing, intense currents, and sheets separating open from closed field lines? What happens? Well, this is a little toy picture of reconnection. What happens is the aurora. I haven't shown a cartoon of the magnetosphere. I suppose I could draw one quickly, but there's chalk lying around there. A quick cartoon is the Earth looks like this, and so does Saturn, and so in a different way. Well, so does Saturn and Jupiter in a different way. There's closed field lines like this. The solar wind is blowing by with its magnetic field that's kind of like that. Here I've got magnetic field lines like this. Coming in here, they get reconnected right here. That means this field line here gets dragged backwards. It goes like this. And it gets dragged backwards like so. So I would... The sun is over here. So the one that's dragged back is the Earth's field line here, which connects to the solar wind field line like that. That connects like so. And so now I have open field lines which connect back to this magnetotail. There's a current sheet down the middle. And for reasons that they don't, despite many years of study, they don't entirely understand, some of this current that's going across the tail like that gets shunted down onto the field lines that map to the pole. While that current flows down there, people know this by putting satellites in there and measuring it, so it's not, it still takes lots of modeling to understand what's going on, but it's not like we have in astrophysics where you're trying to just find some way of getting some photons out and then you can argue ad nauseum. Here, what we have is electrons precipitating like that, also down there, from the tail. You also get some precipitating from the nose. As they map down onto the top of the atmosphere, as they're coming down, they stimulate the oxygen and nitrogen molecules to fluoresce. It's electron impact excitation of this stuff, and that's what you're looking at right there. This is the auroral oval. Here it's getting field lines from the nose. The sun is over there. Here are field lines coming back from the tail. The currents are mapping down into the atmosphere, and then they cross the atmosphere and go back out again. To get fluorescence requires a substantial amount of energy, much more than thermal energies are in this. And so people get up there, and they measure the energies of the particles. And particularly at times when this reconnection is very active, the energies get up into multiple keV. So it's not relativistic, but large compared to thermal energies. I mean, the at temperature of the Earth's atmosphere down in the neutral region is a third of an EV, something like that, less than that, actually. At times, the voltage they measure paraelectric fields in this region. So it's a dense system. It's not vacuum-like, but it has paraelectric fields anyway. Okay.
the plasmas know things that people who read Jackson's textbook don't know. When you learn plasma physics, you learn things that you don't read in Jackson's textbook. This is all fascinating. The fascinating stuff of how the aurora actually appears also is a fascinating dynamics, which is the only thing that's important is what you see coming down is an electron beam accelerated downwards. At times when reconnection is most active, sort of a magnetic storm-like thing, you see the magnetosphere, the size of this polar cap region changing. The voltage drop of stuff coming down along the field lines can be about equal to the total voltage drop across the whole magnetosphere. Go from there to there, okay, and ask yourself, what is the integral along some path? And E is something like minus 1 over C, V solar wind cross B of the Earth out there. And solar wind electric field, because this reconnection has occurred, so the magnetic field lines of the Earth are exposed to the solar wind electrodynamics. So this is an example where, you know, although the plasma is much denser than vacuum conditions, it knows about E parallel. So I'm in the middle of trying to make a model that applies to these relativistic systems that takes advantage of what we know from these guys. The basic point that somewhere around here at this cusp-like line in the magnetosphere, that reconnection is occurring. And this is a toy picture of reconnection flow. I've got plasma flowing by this region coming out from the neutron star. In addition, there's another piece of the electric field such that E cross B is taking some of that plasma and putting it into here, where in this region is the magnetic field is very weak. Okay, and this current sheet in the middle, the B reverses near this Y point, the B goes to zero. So I have a region here where particles are just bouncing around between what amounts to magnetic walls. And the size of this region is something like the Larmor radius of a particle that's in here, calculated based on the temperature and the energies of the particles are in here and the magnetic field just outside. That tends to give rise to dimensions that are in the ballpark of meters. The distance back to the neutron star for some of our fastest rotators, like Crab Pulsar, it's 1,500 kilometers. This is a small region. This is characteristic of reconnection in plasmas. The large-scale dynamics of the magnetic field is altered by small-scale dynamics and special layers and sheets. And if you don't take account of that and you did only ideal MHD, you will not get a correct idea of what the energy flow is like, because altering the topology of the magnetic field changes. So I've got a total electric field. Okay, there's a total perpendicular component electric field. If I didn't took everything else away, this electric field is just corresponding to this thing. The stuff is flowing with E cross B drift velocity. It's basic MHD. Add an extra E perp, which is to do with this reconnection flow right here. And then, is there an E parallel? And we really want to get our hands on this. And one of the things you find out when you play with the description of the plasma is you can get an E parallel. One thing you often used to is there's an Ohm's law. The E is a resistivity times is a J over conductivity, or resistivity times J, and people almost always use that as a model to put dissipation in. But quite typical of this collisionless situation, the mean free path for particles to encounter each other is far larger than the size of the system. So you get things that look like instead like a dynamic statement, that is the particle inertia, which is behind this here. There's a 1 over plasma frequency squared. There's a mass, so that's telling us particle inertia is important. And the time, total time variation, including both spatial variation, is important. And MHD happens if I set the mass of my particles equal to zero. Electrons can adjust instantly to short out the thing. Or the density is really high. And more normally in astrophysics, this plasma frequency is a very big number. You know, it's 10 to the fourth times the square root of the electron density. So, and that typically is very high frequency. But in thin layers like this, this kind of thing is important. There are other things that matter, which for a plasma audience, we could go on at great length about the physics of reconnection in a pair of plasma. So the this is just a statement about what are the dimensions of this region like this, and it's sort of like the local Larmor radius, which is in turn related to the local skin depth, C over omega P. If you do that and you say plasma comes in here by this means and gets squirted out there in terms of current flow, and then I take account of the finite inertia of the beam of particles that I form going down. I also remember as I'm precipitating electrons onto the atmosphere of the star, that puts a cloud of electrons above the surface, and that likes to make ions move up. So I can have in this channel electrons precipitating and ions coming up from the star, and that contributes to the total current flow. That kind of thing, again, is seen in the Earth. You go into the, one of these auroral current channels, electrons are precipitating, ions are coming up, they go right through each other, form a counter-streaming flow. So if I do this and I say, in addition, the length of this region out here is the same as its width, I get a voltage drop parallel to B due to the inertia of these beams of particles, which is like this. And the numbers, I didn't say the number right here, but the number that's in that formula for something like the Crab pulsar is something like GV. So, you know, particles with GeV energy are directly implicated by this kind of thing. And this is the minimal kind of thing. What you actually observe in computer simulations of reconnection, observations of magnetospheric reconnection, reconnection of the solar wind, and laboratory reconnection is the length of this thing can be many hundreds of times the thickness, long extended region. So treat the number I just quoted as a lower limit. But if I take that formula neat, what you get out of this, and you say the energy is high enough that particles are accelerated up till the acceleration is balanced by radiative losses, it's known as the radiation reaction limit, it's thought to describe much of that luminosity versus E dot diagram, then I would get luminosity, that means the acceleration luminosity is equal to the gamma ray luminosity, I get L gamma is proportional E dot to the 1/3. If you put a line like that down on that diagram, it sort of fits. It's not quite as good as the E dot to the 1/2. If you actually look at the force-free simulations, because of numerical resistivity, it gives a rather long extended diffusion region, which this length of the diffusion region can be as much as 10% of the size of the magnetosphere. If that were true, it's just enormous. Yeah. And the truth is not known. You know, this is a place where a certain amount of analytical theorizing about this kind of flow structure can be done, and it's accessible to particle simulations of the plasma. And those will happen in the not very distant future, so this will be more under control. Right now, I'm treating this the length of diffusion region as a parameter and see what it needs to be in order to get something interesting. Okay, so here's some of my numerics. If I say that the length of the diffusion region should be scaled in units of the light cylinder distance, then I get this little pet formula, and that's quite huge for what's happening. If I insist that the acceleration luminosity has to go like the square root of E dot, then I have to have this length of diffusion region in units of its width have a certain dependence on the potential. Is also unknown at the moment. Just treat that as phenomenology. So I'm about done. This is the concluding point. I get L acceleration looks like current times the potential difference in the paraelectric field. If I take my formulae seriously and let L diffusion over RL be a function of the potential, I'll get E dot to the 1/2 if you do this right here. If you really believe L goes like E dot to the 1/2, then in delta phi up there, just treat that as a constant. That would do what you want. The current itself is C times the potential. The potential is the square root of E dot. Alice Harding and I, for different reasons, made the same this observation back in the era, previous gamma ray telescope era. And I ran into one of the observers, and he said, "You must feel really good because that's what we're saying." Yeah. do I really believe what I said then? And he says, well, why are you skeptical? And I said, never mind. The reason to be skeptical has to do with this whole long song and dance, which is far from complete. So you need a reconnection theory to do something about it. And that's coming. The situation we're in is quite reasonable. To say you got the potential drop just a constant is something I haven't included. If the potential drop of the counterstream beams is large enough, the accelerated particles will radiate gamma rays, and those gamma rays can convert to pairs even out in the outer magnetosphere. If you do that enough, that it probably shuts off the accelerating voltage. You remember I had this formula up a bit before where E parallel is proportional to 1 over plasma frequency squared times the time or spatial variation of the current. If I make omega p go to infinity by making the density go to infinity, I'll shut it off. That's many ways of saying that, but that's one of them. So that's a not unreasonable accounting for why it is you see this thing right here. And it's not bad relative to the data, but it's also not great. But then what are these distance errors doing to us? You see something interesting down here where the thing really falls off that curve. And this is probably the point where the voltage drops aren't enough that you're getting radiation losses limiting the amount of acceleration in the first place, which is itself very interesting. I went the wrong way, sorry. So this is my last in the way in which Homer and other such people would tell an epic story. They start in medias res, right in the middle of the thing. And we're actually more in the opening paragraph, and Spitkowski and I have a project where I'm responsible for this kind of, what you might call a subgrid model. And what we're interested in doing, if this can be pushed to the point where we have some trust in it, is to fold it into his force field magnetosphere thing. And the fact that luminosity in gamma rays in the radiation reaction limit is the smallest fraction of the spin down says you can do this by perturbation theory. Because putting this in, you're violating force freeness, but it's in a narrow region and the total energy losses are not large compared to the total. But large enough that you learn something interesting. So we think we can do something for the young, high-voltage, bright pulsars where we start with that picture, but instead of painting the field lines with an emissivity, calculated based on what you're seeing. But it's not done yet. This is just for technical interest. People want to know, well, you said it was an electron beam going down. What happens if I flip the magnetic field over? Everything flips over. You have a positron beam going down and you get an electron beam up. The first case was an electron beam down and ions up. That's interesting because it says I'm spitting out into the wind in these high voltages proton or iron ions or something. And that can have interesting radiative consequences out in these nebulae, which people have looked for some based on a different suggestion why you would get such things. Hasn't been seen yet, and maybe the fact I haven't seen it says the whole thing is wrong or because the flux isn't enough or whatever. The standard line for getting the radiation out of a system like this is that it's curvature emission. You're moving on a curved magnetic field line, and that acceleration causes you to radiate. That requires the voltage drops and the accelerated electrons or positrons that get up to multi-TeV energy. On the other hand, there's an interesting thing that happens when the plasma is more complex than that. I have counterstreaming beams. Counterstreaming flows in a plasma are famous for having so-called two-stream instability, creating fluctuations in the local electric and magnetic field. And the conditions that are here such that the instability might be such as to have fluctuations in the electric field that are comparable to the cyclotron frequency. That means that particles which were originally just sitting on field lines in their bottom Landau level don't have to stay there. They're getting kicked, and they get kicked up, which will cause them to synchrotron radiate. And for the young pulsars, that synchrotron radiation is very efficient. So that takes less energy in the original streaming particles to get interesting radiation out. Instead of needing particle energies of 10 to the 12th to 10 to the 13th EV radiate my photons. I can do it by synchrotron emission with energies as low as 10 GeV to 100 GeV, which, you know, is a big number in human language, but small number in this bracket. An interesting thing is there's some observations which say one component of this coherent radio emission, which we don't understand, is closely associated in the time of arrival and some of its fluctuation characteristics, where the X-rays, they are sensitive enough to tell you about variability from pulse to pulse, with one interesting component of the radio emission. And the two-stream instability of this electromagnetic form might be able to do that. So I'm all curious. But all of these things are coming. You're getting a marketing pitch of interesting things that one can do, which has promise. That's where it's at, and thank you for your attention. Sorry to go on too long. The problem is if the audience is not really intimate with magnetized neutron star physics, you end up time talking about background, which eats up some of the time.
So the plan is that you're going to go to the model that an adenine has and then do perturbations on top of that, or are there another component to that infrastructure to try to...
Right now it's dumber. It's just say take what he's got, it's strict force free, and as long as the voltage drops in these beams is small compared to the total magnetospheric drop, just take the zeroth order model of the magnetic field as a beam platform and use it.
Okay.
And not correct it. But it is interesting in the sense that he and Zuning Bai, his student, found that they had to paint the radiating region in a way such the radiation was somewhat displaced from the actual current sheet. And the way they were doing it is they said the radiation is beamed exactly along the magnetic field. So to get the pulse shapes right, they had to displace the radiating layer there. When you put all these electric fields in, the particle orbits are no longer just strictly following B. They're following B plus E cross B drift. And I get these non-reconnection electric fields and the like, which get particles to head off in somewhat different direction. But an interesting possibility is to put that in, again, as sort of a by-hand correction to the model there and see, indeed, let it radiate according to the exact particle orbit. But let the particle orbits not be strictly following the B that's in the model, but add in these extra pieces of electric field that one needs to do all this. That's, again, something for the future. It would be kind of fun if it turns out that the orbits are flowing along B plus deflected in a reconnection electric field. You're measuring this stuff for something that the nearest one of them is 500 parsecs away. Well, we usually do it by sending a satellite out into the medium. So it's, there's another interesting thing to this radiation physics stuff, but I forget what it is now. If it comes back, I'll tell anybody interested.
Isn't, so 500 megaparsecs, that's the closest. How far is it far?
500 parsecs.
500 parsecs, how far is it farthest?
The most distant pulsars we know are in the small Magellanic Cloud.
Oh, okay.
And radio pulsars, the brightness is not large. The typical luminosity in the radio is like ranging from a millionth the solar luminosity to a few tenths of, maybe 10%, 1% of the solar luminosity. So even though radio telescopes are big, the only reason we see these guys at all is because the actual emission physics is something coherent. And the brightness of what you get is far greater than just adding up the brightness of a whole bunch of independently radiating particles. And that's what stopped the subject in many ways, because my favorite analogy is, suppose you had a high-powered laser, and the only thing you know about is you observe the output downstream of the front end of all the amplifiers and all that. And the amplifiers aren't very good. They're full of hot spots and self-focusing of the laser beam, so it's kind of crummy. And you observe that, and the question that you ask yourself or your colleagues ask you is, who was the manufacturer of the initial oscillator in the chain, and how was it constructed? That's a somewhat nasty rephrasing of the question of what is the pulsar radio emission mechanism. It's very difficult to take a saturated amplifier, which is what it looks like, and backtracked what was how the amplifier was built. You know, the way I'd do it is I'd go with a screwdriver and go around to the oscillator chain and unscrew it and look at it. Dealing with the gamma rays is as close as we, pulse gamma rays is as close as we can get to doing that. Oh yeah, I remember the thing I was going to say. The exciting thing of the Bayh and Spitkowski analysis of beaming is they found their analysis of the pulse shapes worked best if they let a fair fraction of the radiation was coming not from within the light cylinder, but from the region that you made the transition from where the field was dipole-like to where it was that of a stellar wind. The field line, bolidal field line is drawn out more or less radially, and the toroidal field wrapped backwards. And if that holds up, it's very exciting because it's a direct probe with incoherent emission of where the dynamics of the magnetosphere is really set, what's happening out near the light cylinder. Well, when the early days when we thought we already modeled it as radiation straight from the polar cap is as far as away you can get from the basic dynamics. So there's some interesting chance that, you know, trying to unscrew this piece of the inscrutable, we'll get something about the way this kind of machine works. And historically, understanding what this machine does, has been the concepts behind it, been very influential on what happens to other neutron star systems with a disk, and even more to black hole systems, which are producing a high-powered jet, which is, most people model it as being a magnetically dominated system like these magnetospheres. And so people are doing force field electrodynamics where the magnetic field is supported in the surrounding disk rather than inside a conducting star. And it's interacting with a rotating hole. Most of the work that's been done has been the hole itself is rotating. Some of the kind of entertaining stuff was done here by the rotation is the holes in orbit around each other, generating a jet, and it's all pointing flux. So the geometry's changed, the underlying thing is, but it's a pulsar. And some of these things, when you get the jet pointing at you, it produces a huge amount of gamma rays. So the details, I wouldn't know whether it can translate this stuff into a black hole and a jet, but you know the physics that's involved and the principles you do is likely to be rather informative. Okay, it's clear that other people want to occupy the room. We quit.